Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about an effort to create Tulsa's first co-housing community. Co-housing is a community of private homes, usually 24 to 30 of families, clustered around a large common house or clubhouse. That clubhouse serves as a common entertaining space, a space for visiting family members, a location for class and workshops, and a range of communal activities. Each private dwelling, while small, have all the traditional elements and amenities of a house. And most importantly, every element of living in a co-housing community is self-governed. Increasingly, the co-housing model has become an alternative to independent living and assisted living in certain areas of the country. But there are relatively few co-housing communities in the Midwest. The Tulsa Senior Co-housing Community would be the first in the city and only the second in the state after Stillwater's Oak Creek Community. The group has been gathering interested parties over the past 5 months and will embark on a formal study course on co-housing with the aim of identifying new members. Their study group one, as they call it, kicks off Tuesday, September 13th at 6 o'clock at Church of the Madeleine at 23rd and Harvard. I'm joined by two representatives of the senior co-housing community, Melanie Fry and Jane Zimmel, to talk with us about co-housing here in Tulsa. Melanie and Jane, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
How did this group get together, this Tulsa Senior Co-Housing Group? What was the reason for coming together at this particular time?
Well, Jane and I had been, I had been injured a couple of years ago. I live in a three-story condo and have always had joint issues, you know, with my knees and hips and stuff like that. And so I kept getting re-injured. You know, I injured a knee and then my hip and then my foot and plantar fasciitis. Who hasn't had that? And I started thinking about my future. Where am I going to live? And about 6 months ago, I fell down my stairs. I wasn't hurt, but I thought, you know, somebody, I wouldn't be found for weeks living here. You know, I'd just be a dried up hairy raisin or something, you know. So I started thinking about communal living and living with other people and who I should live with. And then Jane and I are on a ladies' water volleyball team, and we had been talking about.
Hey, we're two of the younger ones in there.
We're the babies. So that's how we did it. We were with a bunch of our girlfriends, and we thought, you know, this wouldn't be too bad.
Now, when people start having those conversations, a lot of times the model around in this part of the country is some form of assisted living or communal living with the idea that it's eventually a downhill journey.
That's correct.
We're before that.
Co-housing is a little different.
Co-housing is really for able-bodied people. We're before assisted living, before independent living. We're just regular living. The girls in the volleyball group, almost all of us have our own homes, you know, which means we have our own plumbers, our own lawn, people who mow the lawns, people, you know, handymen, all that. And it was, you know, taking all of our time to do that. So with co-housing, you kind of put all that together, share those things. You know, it's just a much simpler way of life. But we were having fun. That's how co-housing starts anywhere. It's a group of friends who get together and they like being around and they say, you know, we should all get up to some houses and live in the same neighborhood and blah, blah, blah. And that's what co-housing
is. Usually
ends
where
up
that, that's where that conversation ends. It's like, yeah, we should all live in the same neighborhood.
Yeah,
but that's
let's all
about
get a tiny
but
house.
This is taking this is co-housing generally is a larger, usually is fairly modest units for each family to live in, but a very large common area that functions in as both sort of a social attractor. It's also a place where if you have family coming in, it can provide housing for family coming in.
The concept of co-housing centers around six fundamental issues. One of them is safety, like I was talking about falling down the stairs and never being found for years and years and years. But it's a shared participatory process, consensus decision-making. We all get together. We all plan the neighborhood design. We plan and design the common facilities. We manage it. The residents manage it. And there are no shared community monies. A lot of people get co-housing confused with communes. And the big difference is that we do not share our money. We don't do that. We share resources and we pool resources, but not money.
So as you began talking about this process, how did the process get started towards actually coming up with a co-housing community?
We started maybe a little bit backwards, but we wanted to make sure we knew what we were talking about before we went to find other people. So we went to a builder and asked if it's possible to build 24 units and a common house or rehab, you know, whatever, to do it. And we gave them a range, monetary range. And we said, is it possible to do this? And they said yes. So then we went out and just started recruiting people.
So we started having meetings, our recruitment meetings, I guess, at the libraries. And we've been at All Souls. We're going to go back to All Souls a couple of times to do more recruitment. But it was sort of just realizing that you can wait, you know, till the kids graduate or till I retire. But we need to get on this. I'm not getting any younger. And I wish that I had thought about this. I turned 65 in less than 30 days. I wish that I had thought of this when I was 55. But at 55, I was not thinking about retirement or health issues, and I didn't want to think about it. And I really regret that.
Well, in fact, there is one. I mean, on the West Coast, there are lots of these co-housing units, and they vary from anywhere from what, about 15 to 16 units. I've seen some as large as 30 or 40 mm-hmm. units. Again, with this community clubhouse space along with private space. And I guess that's the beauty of it. You can be as social as you want, or when you don't feel like being social, you don't have to be social at all.
That's precisely correct. We'd asked, there's one co-housing community in the state of Oklahoma. It's in Stillwater, and it's gorgeous. They've done a beautiful, beautiful job with that. And we had asked the lady who was sort of the organizer over there, if she told us, which I was very surprised, that most of the people, she said 80% of the people that live in co-housing are introverts. And that's what appeals to me, is that I can choose to be alone, which I really enjoy my own company, or I can be with my buddies, who I really enjoy their company.
So when you talk to the people in Stillwater, what was the process for how they found the people who eventually was a part of a co-housing? Because I know a lot of people seem like they're interested until they actually, there's sort of a process where there's money, but there's also a different situation than they're used to living. So it's taking people out of their comfort zone. How do they find the people?
There are a lot of different things. It's a mental thing, and then you have to find people that you like and want to live with. And so it's tricky in that way. I'm not sure how Stillwater did it. I think they have a lot of professors who were involved in that.
They had, somehow they had got committees going there, if I recall this correctly, because we've talked to her many times. Very nice lady. But I think what they did was they had a committee. They put together a committee, and they once a week they would go to a church or a Rotary Club or whatever, and they really, really worked hard to get their buyers and their participants going, and it's been very successful over there.
And that's how most of them get started. I forget what they call the people who do that.
The Burning Souls.
The Burning Souls. It takes a couple of people just to get it started, but we're not supposed to. That's Melanie and I have kind of done that. But it's not that we stay in charge. Yeah, right. Ultimately, everybody's in charge. No one's more important than anybody else.
Now, you're starting a study group coming mm-hmm. up. Tell us a little bit about this study group. It's beginning, I guess, Tuesday the 13th,
correct? That is correct. It's called Study Group 1, which I think is an incredibly creative title. But it's the purpose of Study Group 1 is to really highlight the opportunities, challenges, difficulties of aging in place, and the advantages of or that the community offers in comparison with the alternatives. Because what Jane and I have found is that there are plenty of alternatives if you're upper income. You've got Montreux and Inverness and places like that, and they're lovely. They're beautiful. I can't afford that, but they're lovely. There is plenty of low-income housing for people that all they have, their Medicare checks or their mm-hmm. retirement checks and stuff. There are some facilities out there for middle-income people, not a lot, and that's the gap that we hope to close, is the middle-income people. Because in 14 years, one in every five Americans will be over 65. Where are you going to put us and let us have fun?
And we'd like to think of ourselves as the middle child of retirement living. So with all the problems, you know, all middle children have.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you go into co-housing, I guess you're still investing in a property.
Yes.
So once your physical limitations means you need more services than co-housing, I mean, co-housing doesn't provide services, individual services like health services. When you have your health declines to a point where you need assisted living or something like that, you still have an asset that you can sell to help finance.
Yes, because yes. You do own your own home. However, in co-housing, at least this is what Stillwater did, and I think this is a very good idea, their dwellings ranged anywhere from about 700 square feet to, I think, around 1,200 square feet. Some of those units were two bedrooms, so you could have a family member or caregiver live with you and take care of you. Or the other alternative, one of the main reasons for the common house is to have family or caregivers live there, stay there while you're recuperating from something, you know, like a heart surgery or a joint replacement or whatever, that you've got somebody on site. But the thing about co-housing is that since it's resident-run and resident-driven, you want to maintain a healthy population, people that can participate. And prior to moving in, you decide, the residents decide, what are the criteria for people when they need to move out, than when mm-hmm. they need a higher level of care than can be, because it's always a safety issue.
Right. But it's also, I think, the idea of having a vibrant social setting as you age probably helps prolong that social activity.
I mean,
a physical mobility mm-hmm. and sort of mental acuity and everything. Just because you're not sitting at home watching television or, you know, maybe going out and gardening or something in the backyard, you're really involved to a greater degree than maybe otherwise.
Absolutely.
Right. There's no management company running this. The residents run it. So the residents, there may be a finance committee, there may be a management committee, there may be a landscape committee, a maintenance committee. You run it yourself, and that's why you have to be able-bodied to do this.
Plus, studies have shown over and over and over and over that the more social you are and the more active you are, not like going to the gym active, but just your daily activities of daily living, will add 10 years to your life. I mean, you're leaving 10 years on the table if you're not doing this. Also, one of the things that we want to incorporate into our co-housing community, and so far everybody's okay with that, are Blue Zones principles. The National Geographic Society hired a guy, Dan Buettner, to travel the world and find the areas where people not just live longer, they live longer better. They're healthy, mm-hmm. you know, into their 90s and their 100s and so on. And those principles he put in a book. But it's all about diet. It's not just about drinking wine. It's about drinking wine with your friends.
And laughing. And laughing. Yeah. Having conversations.
Interacting. Being engaged in the world. Because I don't know about you, if your parents are still living. I saw my mother, who was a social butterfly. People loved her. She was hilarious, funny, great artist, etc. Just absolutely tank in her 60s and 70s from not... Because she had a mindset that was, oh, I'm retired, so I'm just going to lay around. And it was horrible for her. It was a very bad thing to do. Her social life was, she had no social life anymore after she retired. And it was, I saw her decline because of that.
So this study group is going to spend about 10 weeks learning about this process. At the end, how many co-housing folks do you want involved? Is it do you have a set number in mind?
The book recommends 15 to 25. The people from Stillwater will tell you no fewer than 24 and probably no more than 30. And that's because it takes that many to run it. And after 30, they say it gets a little political. But under 24, you know, if people travel in the summer or during holidays, there aren't enough people left to run the place.
Right, right.
So that's kind of what we're looking for.
Now, at this point, you don't have a site. And really, as far as... you perhaps have some principles you want to be guided by when the community is there, but you really, this is all to be decided, correct?
Pretty much. I mean, it's not like we're inventing the wheel. Other communities have sprung up and they have great principles and guidelines and covenants and all that other stuff, but we will determine what ours are. The residents determine that.
Yeah.
We've been meeting once every 2 weeks with a group interested in this and most of whom will go into this study group. And it's really just to talk about the principles of co-housing. And we have people in that group who some want to go off the grid, you know, with permaculture. We don't want to do that. I want to be very much on the grid, but some people don't. Also, one other aspect of co-housing is intergenerational. And we have some people who are interested in that. So, I don't know that everyone in our group right this second will end up in senior co-housing, but we may start other branches.
I mean, that's the whole thing, is that you could come out of this with more people, but you could also see two different co-housing units.
Mm-hmm. Or three.
Right.
Yeah. Some people are interested in mixed income as well.
Mm-hmm. The buzzword that you're going to hear, I mean, I've been hearing about excellence for 43 years of being in the advertising community. If I hear that word one more time, I'm going to kill somebody. But the word you're going to hear more and more and more and more is community. And this is all about community. It's about having people around you who are fun, people who care about you. I mean, with volleyball, part of what we do is laugh and swear. And when you do that for 3 hours at a time,
therapy.
It's very fun. Your body feels better. Your mind feels better. You know, we've forgotten how to play and have fun. But we shouldn't forget that, because we can still do that.
And fun is absolutely essential to mental health and well-being.
Right. Yeah. And even when we looked at the, you know, retirement places around town, even if we could afford to live there, we wouldn't. You know, we're not fancy people. We're festive people.
My guests today are Melanie Fry and Jane Zimmel. They are two members of a Tulsa senior co-housing community that are looking for more members to come together to build the first co-housing community here in Tulsa, one in the state in Stillwater, many on the West Coast, many up in New England and that,
like,
and Colorado in the Mountain West, but not many in the middle of the country. And it's a new way of living as you age. It's usually for empty nesters and middle-aged to early elderly communities.
Well, think about your own parents. Yeah. Where did your folks live? Here in town?
Yeah, they lived, yeah.
And they've got a big house that you grew up in and
right.
all that stuff. And eventually...
Then, yeah, everybody's gone, and they've got the house still.
And yeah. they've still got the yard and the appliances.
And the roof and the gutters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Fascinating.
So a lot of people want to downsize. One of the things that, or several things that, the 10-week workshop is going to cover is aging in place and aging in a community, working together as a community, the realities of getting older, co-care, outside care, finances, economics. We have a lot of stuff to offer during this 10-week study group, and I think it's free. There's no charge.
Probably, there's no obligation either if you
no
want to join the community at all.
Except you might want to eat the cookies that we bring occasionally. But other than that, there really is nothing. There are some workbooks. If you decide that you want to do the workshop, you might want to purchase a workbook.
Yeah, you have to do that. But really, the aging in place and aging successfully workshop is just having you take a look at aging because people don't do that. They don't plan for it. They don't really think about it. And if they do think about it, it's mostly in denial.
Yeah. Now, you're looking for this group to come together. At this point, you have no location, right? You're open
That's
to
correct.
That. Mm-hmm. This group will decide where you want to locate, what the look of the housing will look. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of co-housing has natural areas.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, nature is often a big component of it, although now you're starting to see co-housing units that are set on industrial sites, former industrial sites where you're rehabbing an old site. Any of those decisions been made or been talked about at this point?
We've looked at lots and lots of stuff. Ideally, if you're going to be a co-housing purist, the ideal co-housing is walkable. It's going to be where
right.
you can walk to goods and services, where you have to sort of go a little bit out of your way to get your mail or a little bit out of your way to get your groceries to your house. It just keeps you more active in a natural fashion rather than where you're going, oh, crud, I got to go to the gym today. It's like, oh, I got to go get my mail and walk to the store and walk get my haircut or whatever. So ideally, it's an urban walkable environment.
And in addition to keeping you moving, it keeps you visible to your
yeah.
neighbors. If you have to walk to get your mail, usually the mailboxes are in the common house. So everybody who's looking out their window can see that you're there. They might want to invite you in for a bagel
so
and cream cheese.
So that's the safety issue. Yeah.
Friendliness. And
right,
just,
right.
yeah.
Kitchens also, the way co-housing is, there's a specific way to build co-housing. One of the attributes is to have the kitchen window facing out towards the common area so that you're standing there eating or actually doing your dishes, you can see your neighbors. So if I look out and I see Jane, I'm like, dude, what's Janie doing out there? Let's play. Let's party, whatever.
Uh-huh.
So you can keep an eye on each other
right.
and interact.
And the common houses, oftentimes, as I mentioned, they'll have some housing within them,
mm-hmm.
for especially like if you have a community of empty nesters, if such and such family comes in, you can put them up in the common house for a few days.
Mm-hmm, right.
I know that's been a big right. issue in some common houses.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
freeloaders.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. But
the brother-in-law.
But you also have a probably social activities that will take place within the common room. There's usually a kitchen and there's like a multi-purpose room in
right.
many ways.
I mean, you can watch movies. The one in Stillwater has a game room.
Mm-hmm.
The other things that you can do in a common house, like in the little unit, in the units that you live in, there's a room probably for a stacking washer and dryer.
Mm-hmm.
In the common house, there's a big washer and dryer.
Big
so if
industrial.
You have to do a comforter or something, then you can go do it there. If you have a lot of big pots and pans that won't fit in your little kitchen in your unit, you can put them in the common house. And when there are community dinners,
we can all
everybody's
use
pooled pots and pans, and you don't have to worry about storing them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it sounds like really interesting. How long do you think this process is going to be before you break ground and before you're ready to build? Do you have any sense of how long this is going to take?
Well, hopefully it's going to be within a year and a half. Generally, the time frame is about 2.5 to 3 years for a co-housing community from the first meeting to here's your key to your new home is
right.
about 3 years. Something like that. So we've been meeting probably for about 4 or 5 months. After we finish study group one, we'll have another group called Getting It Built, where we'll bring in some architects, McCammon and Durrett from California, and they'll show us how to work as a group to design, pick the site, all that other stuff.
Wow. And so this will be like group dynamics on every aspect of the construction of the site.
And that's a huge issue. It's big.
Yeah, how do you're a therapist, Melanie. How do people work through that? Because you get 20 people together, they're going to have 20 different ideas of what it's supposed to look like and what it's going to look like in their head and getting that to reality.
That is true. There are one of the things that I'm going to talk to our group about is as we progress and proceed through this experience, I'd like to have somebody come in as an outsider to facilitate the groups, you know, somebody who is not one of us, so that they can keep us together and keep us, you know, working as a group. Because in co-housing, nobody carries any more weight than the other person. And it's really nice to have somebody, I think, who is an expert at group communication and getting things done. I would love that. Because there's nothing that irritates me more than just kind of going in a circle.
Yeah, right. And there are big picture things that keep people from doing this, and then there are just like little things.
Six, for example.
Like downsizing. Mm-hmm. People do not know how to get rid of things, and they end up drowning in their things. They have to dust them or store them or put them somewhere, and they're things that maybe their parents left for them that they don't want and their kids don't want, but they don't know how to get rid of them. I mean, just things. We don't want to be drowning in our things. We want to get rid of our things and have some fun.
And you mentioned downsizing several times. And really, if you have a 2,000 square foot house or something like that, or even an 1,800 foot condominium, you're talking about a significantly smaller space, like 1,000 square feet, maybe 1,200 at the outside. These are going to be smaller units, correct?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things we noticed, or that I did, I noticed in Stillwater, is that people in their homes, because we toured homes, they had an open house that day, they really took pride in what they kept. And it was able to be displayed instead of homes that were just over, you know, just hanging with, you know, with chotch.
Doilies and figurines and
yes.
fake flowers.
Precious moments and things like that.
Right.
Books mainly, too.
Right. Well, how many people do you have in the group now, and how many people are you looking for?
Well, we have about 25, don't we, in the group?
About 20 or 5 or 30, and not all people come to all meetings.
And not all people have made that final commitment as well.
Nobody
has. No one's made a final commitment. We have how many people on the email list?
80
some on the email list, and we now have a Facebook page, and we have about 300, 350?
Mm-hmm, almost 400, yeah.
On the Facebook page. So people are looking. We have friends who really don't want to go through the agonizing process of this, but I think we'll come in at the end and say, well, where is it and how much is it? But the fun part, or the grueling part, however you want to look at it, is the process.
Yeah. Well, it gets started. This study group one takes place Tuesday, September 13th at the Church of the Madeleine.
Correct.
Are people going to show up?
Sure. It's 6 o'clock.
How do they get more information from your particular group?
I think the best way would probably go to our Facebook page. It's Tulsa Senior Co-Housing. That's pretty easy. It'll pop right up. And also, you can reach us by email at TulsaCoho@gmail.com, and we will answer your emails. Again, that's TulsaCoho, C-O-H-O, @gmail.com.
And if you go to the Facebook page, it's under events. It'll tell you location, times, and give you two links to get the workbook.
All right. Well, Tulsa's first senior co-housing community. It may be happening in the next year or two. Melanie and Jane, thanks very much for joining
us. Rich, thank you, always.
Melanie Fry and Jane Zemel are from the Tulsa Senior Co-Housing Community. They'll be starting a 10-week study group on how to live in co-housing, which begins Tuesday, September 13th at 6 o'clock at Church of the Madeleine at 23rd and Harvard. The group will meet every Tuesday for 10 weeks. For more information on the Tulsa Co-Housing Community, you can email them at TulsaCoho@gmail.com or visit their Facebook page. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
I personally don't like sales taxes particularly. That was OU President David Boren back in January during an interview we did for Intermission Magazine, talking about State Question 779, an amendment on November's ballot that would raise sales taxes statewide by 1% to help fund education in Oklahoma, that the cornerstone of this amendment, the increase itself, is loathed by the man who came up with the idea, is, all things considered, just about perfect for how things work in Oklahoma, which has cut more from education since 2008 than any other state in the union. So we're in no position to quibble about how we claw our way out of a ditch we so willingly and purposefully dug for ourselves. And Boren has a final word for his critics. And again, I say, if you have a better plan to raise the $600 million, let's see it. Here's how State Question 779 would work. If passed by voters, it would institute an across-the-board 1% sales tax and earmark those funds specifically for higher general and technical education. The money raised would be constitutionally protected, meaning some well or not so well-meaning legislator couldn't divert the funds to prisons or tourism's or to his or her dreams of gutting public education and replacing it with for-profit charter schools and Christian madrasas. By some estimates, 779 will bring in approximately $615 million per year in state revenue beginning July 1, 2017. Further, it will guarantee public school teachers a $5,000 per year raise, which is good because at the moment the state ranks 48th nationally in teacher salaries. The new revenue will be divvied up something like this, 69% or so for public education, 19% for higher education, and about 3% for career tech. Seems a little bit low for career tech, but that's another commentary. Let's continue. There's also language in the measure, and this is key, that will prevent representatives from supplanting general revenue education funds, think of it as a legislative three-card Monty, with projected state question 779 money. Now, not even our state legislature would do something so cynically counterproductive, right? I mean, they wouldn't take money out of one pot and then just put it back in with the other one and call that an increase. Of course not. They did something even worse. They cut the baseline from public education funding before 779 even becomes law. To put this in real cash money, in fiscal year 2017, higher education will receive $154 million less than it did in 2016. Now, let's say 779 passes and, in fact, brings in the $615 million. Higher education's cut of that will be about $118 million, which means even if all goes well, higher education in Oklahoma in 2017 will be down $35 million from 2016. Nice, huh? More to the point, State Question 779 is an awful, regressive bill. State sales tax increases is an awful way to fund state education. Here's why. Poor people spend a greater portion of their income on goods and services that are taxed than do wealthier Americans. The more you raise the sales tax, the less disposable the income, and there already isn't much disposable income. And in Oklahoma, unlike many states, food and clothing is subject to sales tax. And while we're on the subject, why do we tax saran wrap and underwear in Oklahoma, but not pet grooming and investment counseling? But the larger issue here is one of responsibility and maturity. A state that wants quality education should consider the revolutionary idea of paying for it. Not with gimmicks like sales tax, earmarks, and for that matter, lotteries, but general revenue funds exclusively, and not have it augmented by some slot player on a lucky ducky machine. And if there isn't enough money in the budget to pay for such quality education, raise or restore the taxes that caused the mess in the first place. David Borden did the only thing he could here, though for the love of God, do we really want the dean of Oklahoma politics in the twilight of his career schnurring around the state on behalf of education? He should be applauded. For years, state legislators thought tax breaks for horizontal drillers were more important than class sizes and laughable tax rebates were more important than teacher salaries. So clearly, something had to be done. State Question 779, unfortunately, is not it. It's the wrong idea at the wrong time, inefficient, subject to manipulation, and burdens the very people who can least afford it. It simply cannot be approved in November. But of course, it must be.
Barry Friedman is a columnist for the Tulsa Voice, a writer and essayist, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.